Okay, then just sit comfortably, or as comfortably as is possible, in this room. So first of all, I just wanted to say a little bit about how we might manage the next 8 weeks together. I mean, we'll be very intimate, we'll know that, if we're starting. So just to say, I'd really encourage you to come to the 8 weeks. It's a drop-in seminar, so you can just drop in. You don't have to book, you don't have to, if you miss one. Each week, I hope, will stand alone, so you can just drop in. But I really encourage you to come to the 8 weeks. Probably next year, will be a course, an 8-week course, based on the book that I'm writing. In fact, what I'm going to be doing for the next 8 weeks is trying it out on you. Or rather, actually, getting us to try and think, well, what I should write in my book. I've only written 2 chapters. I've talked about it so much, I've only written 2 chapters. Yes, if you can, just come for the 8 weeks. And just come whether you feel like it or not. Otherwise, the first week is like the first day of a diet, you know, when you're full of optimism, and then, you know, before you know it, you're back to where you were. Yeah, so just come for the 8 weeks and just see how you feel once you've seen the whole kind of arc of our spiritual life. And as I say, I want to emphasise that it is our spiritual life. But as you can tell, there's a lot of us here, and I hope that all of you will stay. So what I'd like to suggest, because I want to try and make it possible that we meet each other and spend time with each other, but I also want to make it possible for people to be quiet and meditative as well. Yeah. So what I'd like to suggest is, when you come to the centre next week, if you fancy, you can just come along straight into this room and start and meditate or lie down for a bit or whatever, just to sort of relax before the seminar begins. So you might even come a little bit earlier and just just sit quietly for a while. You might, let's say, just lie down in a little corner somewhere. And then what we'll do in the tea break, we'll have this as a silent space as well. So some people, a lot of you want to go and get your tea and chat to people, but some people want to just be a bit quieter than that, and I think that's just as good. You're welcome to do that. So I want to turn this room into the place where we'll just have it in silence. And what we'll do as well, even at the end, we'll have silence in this room, because some people will want to just sort of stay with how the seminar has left them, or how the mantra, or how the meditation has left them. So we'll just have silence in this room, and then we can just talk as soon as we get into the reception room. And let's have that silence, a real silence, so not just a legal silence of not talking, but, not gesticulating to each other and saying, for the tea and all that sort of thing. And let's have a text silence as well. So I know sometimes people need to, nowadays you can do this, you can check your emails on your phone. Mine dates back before phones were invented. So if you need to do that, let's do all of that kind of stuff with the tea and the biscuits. Yeah? So let's have this as a kind of silent, sacred place, where no text message arrives or leaves. Yeah. And if you're tweeting, you can't tweet, "I'm in the shrine room." You have to tweet, "I'm in the reception room," because I'm not allowed to do this in the shrine room. A bit longer, okay? Okay. So what we're going to be exploring for these 8 weeks is the journey and the guide. And that is going to be the title of the book when I finish writing it. And it's the title of this seminar. So I wanted to call it the journey because our human life is a journey. It must be the primary metaphor of our life. It's a journey. It's a journey from birth to old age and death. It's a journey in lots of other ways as well. And sometimes we don't get to old age, in a way, old age is if you're lucky. But it's a journey, isn't it? Our human life is a journey. Even every day feels like a journey. You look back at your life and it really does feel like a journey. Interestingly, what I've noticed and what other order members have noticed is that journey changes. The metaphor of that journey changes very, very deeply when you're ordained. I've often been able to give my life story up to the point of being ordained. that I've never really been able to quite give my life story after I've been ordained, and I've never quite understood why. I've even tried to do it, but it doesn't have any story anymore, strangely. When, before I was ordained, I can say, well, I was an unhappy child, and then I found it very difficult in this village I lived in, and then I went and became a nurse, and I was an unhappy nurse. And then I went to an art school, and I was an unhappy art student. etc., etc. I can say one thing happened and then another. I came along to the class, I came along to the Wednesday class. As soon as I came to this class, I somehow knew I was a Buddhist. I don't know how I knew, because I didn't know really what Buddhism was, but I felt instinctively, immediately, that I was a Buddhist, and I had been a Buddhist, and I always would be a Buddhist. And then I asked for ordination, and then and I got ordained. But after then, I can never quite tell a story. It's as if when you're ordained, and I'll be coming back to this later on in the seminar, it's as if when you're ordained, it's not that nothing happens anymore. It's just it doesn't happen in a sequential story of this and this and this. It's kind of happening in more of the same. So, for instance, I've been teaching pretty much most weeks since I've been ordained. I've been going to Sibford, for instance. For some of you who've just been back from, I've been going to Sibford since before I was ordained, I think. I can't remember, it's so long ago. And they also, it's just the same in a way. It's not literally the same, but it's not as if I did this Sibford and then that happened and I went to this Sibford. You just can't do that. I've lived upstairs or I've lived in the premises for 25 years, something like that. And it's not just those lifestyle things, it's also a sense in which when I was ordained, that sort of completed my journey to find out what the nature of meaning was, and all I need to do from now on is become more and more of that. When you're ordained, you're first of all, you're private, and I didn't mean to say all this, you'll be finding me do that a lot. When I was privately ordained, you're privately ordained and you're publicly ordained, and the private ordination represents your personal commitment to the spiritual life of your life, which is already a spiritual life. It just represents the moment that you really effectively take hold of your spiritual life, which you've already had since the moment you were born. But ordination marks the conscious, wholehearted taking on of that life in its depths and its heights. When I was ordained, we just went to this place on our own and we were ordained. And it feels like all a part of me has stayed there ever since. As if all my life since then, the valuable parts of my life, the worthwhile parts of my life worth talking about, are just me getting more and more ordained. Me taking on the spiritual life that is my life more and more effectively, more and more dynamically. And it's not been by any means without difficulty, without problems. In fact, in some ways the difficulties started then. But it feels like the shape of my life changes from something that's sequential to something that's spatial, to something that is that changes from a path to a mandala. I don't know quite why I didn't quite mean to say that, but it just suddenly occurs to me that that's my own experience. But nevertheless, our experience is a journey, but that journey can become really quite mysterious. It becomes less, I suppose what I'm saying is it becomes less and less of a literal journey of one thing happening, then another thing happening. And I've called the book and I've called this seminar The Journey and the Guide. And of course the Buddha is the guide. He's the guide, par excellence. In the winter retreat we called, the name of the retreat was The World Teacher. And I think of him as the guide in that sense, the world teacher. He's the person, he's the one, obviously from a Buddhist perspective, who has travelled the whole journey and can speak most profoundly, most authoritatively about the journey. I can only speak about the journey that I've managed to traverse, and I can speak about what my teachers have said about the rest of the journey. And I've got hints and clues of that, I've got experiences of that, I've got even some degree of that. And I've definitely seen it in other people that I know who've gone further on that journey. Some of them have gone so far, I frankly can't see how they get there. They got there. So with my own teacher, Sangharakshita, you just can't work him out. Don't bother. I mean, you just... I mean, he's a bit odd, but you know, he's a very unusual man. But even notwithstanding that, you just can't work him out. You can't understand him. You can't really see how he got to where he was, where he is. It's as if in his journey he sort of went behind a copse of trees, and then he turns up, and you can't work out, well, how did he get there? But certainly with some of my friends who I look up to, well, it's very, very clear that they're further ahead in the journey, and they can sort of tell me what it's like up there. Yeah? So we've got this journey, and we've got the guide, and the guide par excellence is the Buddha, because he's the only one who's completed the journey, and therefore can talk about the whole journey. So what I want to do in these 8 weeks is keep moving between our journey of human life, which is already a journey and is a spiritual journey, a quest, whether we know it or not, and I'm going to keep on linking that, connecting that with the Buddha's journey, Siddhartha's journey, his journey to enlightenment. Yeah? And I think that by doing that we make it much clearer what the journey is. So first of all, we have to imagine this young man. We have to imagine a young man in India 2,500 years ago, and quite a privileged young man. Very different stories about his childhood. In the early sutras he says very, very little about it, actually. But you know, all kinds of myths and legends have grown up about his life, and I think they have a certain truth, a spiritual truth. I've been writing it in my book, and I just want to tell the story again. And every time you tell the story, even if you try to be accurate, which I don't, frankly, you sort of tell the story in a slightly new way. You sort of tell it again, and it's a story passed down. And stories, as they're passed down, they slightly change and deepen, and something happens to stories. Yeah? So I want to sort of tell the story in my own way, which is, it isn't. I'm not trying to tell an autobiography of the Buddha. So let's imagine him then as this young prince. Sometimes that's how he's portrayed, a young prince, and his father's a king. According to tradition, his mother died when he was born. A young boy, in a wealthy and privileged background. And from what we can tell, and let's just imagine this, he was a very healthy young man. He was very sporting. I was saying in my talk on Saturday, I'd much prefer that Buddhism was associated with what they called dangerous, extreme sports, thank you. Because yeah. That was something like the with Siddhartha. Siddhartha was a pre-enlightened Buddha. He was a very active, vigorous, sporting, athletic young man. Very healthy young man. At least that's the image that I have of him. He obviously thought very deeply, but not in a kind of heady, abstracted, intellectual sense. He thought into his experience very deeply. One of the things that happens with us, I think, is that we think not into our experience, not about our experience, but from thoughts we've already had, from theories we've got, from the sorts of things that our parents told us before we were seven. So our thinking isn't so often to do with what is my experience, what do I actually experience, what is in front of me. Our thinking is based on our already a sort of abstracted thought. So a thought is fighting with another thought or another theory. So we're thinking from mid-air, if you see what I mean, rather than thinking in our experience, with our experience, about our experience. And that thinking is also an emotional inquiry, an intuitive, emotional, intellectual inquiry. So often our thinking isn't that, it's just a thinking that's just to do with other people's thoughts, and other people's thoughts have entered their own mind. So he obviously thought very deeply in this sense, as somebody who thinks deeply about life, about their direct experience of it. It was very unlikely he could read, for instance. So he would have just thought, yeah, about his life. He seemed to have been incredibly energetic, especially in the sense that he could see something and then act. He could just see that something needed doing and he would act. That to see was to act. So often with us, we see something and we think, was able to do something about that. And we resist, come on, we can do it. But for him, he just see it in an act. Very, very healthy, vigorous, clean kind of activity. Not sort of caught up with self-doubts and neuroses and self-questioning and worries about himself, if you see what I mean. Siddhartha also, at least from the stories, and let's just imagine this, he had a beautiful wife and a young son. So he'd known sex, he'd known sexual love, he'd known that whole arena of life. There's always been questions, haven't there, about Jesus, and anyway, never mind, we won't go into that. But we know that the Buddha had sex. I won't talk you through the biology, but just because he had a son, we know that, at least in this imaginative story. So there you are, you've got someone who's a healthy, in this case, young man. And what happens, according to the story, is he gets bored. According to the story, the king wanted to keep him inside this palace that he was living in because he didn't want him to think, really, what it boils down to. He didn't want him to think. And the only value of suffering in the world is that it makes you think. It makes you stop and think. People very rarely think very much when they're happy. In a way, this is one of the problems of our concern with happiness. Even though happiness is so important, actually, it often doesn't provoke us to think. The value of suffering is that it makes us think. And somehow the king knew that. The king realised that the best thing to stop his son thinking was to keep him inside a pleasure palace, basically. Because when he was born, a soothsayer said that your son will either grow up to be a great king or a great spiritual master. And his father, the king, thought, well, I definitely wanted to be a great king. I'm not having him doing that spiritual master thing. So let's just keep him in this pleasure palace where he won't have to think, he won't think. And of course, Siddhartha gets bored. Pleasure, after a certain while, is boring. You can't infinitely extend pleasure. It just becomes, in fact, it becomes painful, doesn't it? When you, even if you just try and listen to too much music, eventually it becomes painful. Eating pleasurable food eventually becomes painful. Pleasure is not infinitely extendable. In fact, you get diminished returns. Don't you? So he decides to go out, and he goes out into the town. He goes out with his charioteer called Chanda. Now, many of you will know the story, so I won't go through it stage by stage. But first of all, he goes out and sees an old man. And then he goes out and he sees a sick man, and then he goes out and he sees someone who's died. And in the story it says he sees it for the first time. But probably it's much more likely that it was as if he'd seen it for the first time. He might, of course, never gone out at all. It might be a wonderful metaphor for I suddenly looked around and I saw that my father was old. And I saw that I was going to become old. I suddenly looked around and I saw my father being sick, or my wife being sick, or my son being sick. And I realised that that was intrinsic to life. Or I looked around and I realised that this life would end with death. Yeah. So the difference about Siddhartha is that he sees that for the first time. And I find it very interesting. All of these parts of the story are woven metaphor and myth and story and history and legend, all of which I think has got spiritual meaning. But I think even the name of the charioteer that takes him out has got spiritual meaning. So his name is Chanda, and Chanda means interest. So there you are. He takes Chanda, and he asks Chanda to take him out and show him something. So isn't that interesting? He's asking his interest to be interested in something. So what's happening is he's arousing his interest in old age, in suffering, and in death. He's getting interested in those things. He's mobilizing interest. He's really interested. And Chanda means fascination. So it doesn't mean trying to be interested. It doesn't mean I should be interested in this. It doesn't mean, oh yes, we go old, don't we? And it's not a heady thing. It's real interest, real attention, real fascination. It's something deeply absorbed. Yeah. So that's what Chanda means, and it's Chanda that takes him out of the palace to see these three great sights. And I even think it's interesting that the story is he leaves the palace. So I take that to mean that he leaves his basic mindset behind. He leaves his conventional mindset behind. He leaves the person who he thinks he is behind, including what his parents think he's going to be, what his wife wants him to be, what his son hopes to be him to be. In other words, he leaves behind all his roles. His role as a father, as a son, as a friend of all these courtiers, as an influential local person, as a king-to-be. He just leaves all that behind. What's interesting, he doesn't leave very long because he goes out, sees something, is interested in it, is fascinated by it, and it's too much, and he goes back into this mindset, into this habitual, conventional, world that he's been given, the life he's been given. Like I was saying, our life has been given to us by our parents with their expectations, by our wife or our husband with their needs, by our children with their desire for us and so on, by our friends who want us to be a particular kind of person, who want us to be entertaining if we think we're an entertaining person, or serious if we think we're a serious person. So the Siddhartha, the young man, goes out from that for a while, leaves that behind, and then it's too much and comes back, takes refuge again back in that world. Yeah? And of course he sees that we grow old, we grow sick, and we die. And he really sees that. He doesn't just cognitively notice that. He doesn't assent to that. He just sees that. Right through. He sees what that means for him, for his son, for his wife, for his father, for everyone around him, for the whole world. And what that has always meant. So what this means, what this comes to mean, is that the Buddha's life actually starts with wisdom, doesn't it? The Siddhartha's life, this is a wisdom experience that he's having. So actually in the start of the path is the end of the path. You see what I mean? Really, all you would need to do, I need to say one more sight at the end to correct this. But in a sense, all you need to do is see those sights deeply enough, really deeply enough, completely, and there you are, that is wisdom. So even though this is the start of Siddhartha's story, and this is long before the attainment of enlightenment, awakening, actually the story is starting with wisdom. So, what does that mean for us just now, in our journey, in our life? So what I want to argue, is what I want to start to talk about, is why don't we see things like that? We're confronted by the facts of life every day. We're confronted every time we look into the mirror. We're confronted with our friends. Sometimes when you see a friend after a long time, can be really quite shocking. You think they've grown old. You sort of strangely feel that you haven't, and that they've grown old. We're confronted by sickness, either our own sickness or those people around us. But sometimes when our friends get sick or someone we know gets sick, we sort of think, oh yes, they're sick. How terrible, what a tragedy for them. But somehow, quietly in the back of our mind, that won't happen to us. And of course, you know, most importantly, we see someone die. I've got to the age now where every time I hear someone's died, I want to know their age. There's a certain moment where you suddenly, the first question you want to ask is, how old were they? And you start to find yourself more and more in the bracket where people die. Actually, people will die all the time, at any time, but nevertheless, you start to feel yourself in that bracket. So why don't we really see that? It's the most obvious fact about our life, and yet if we really saw that, our life would completely change, wouldn't it? We'd stop watching rubbishy television. We'd stop getting involved in silly arguments. We'd stop going from one website to another. We'd stop just flicking through our Facebook feed and seeing pictures of people's cats and snow scene. Another baby, you know, another snow scene. You know, I'm looking out of my window, there's about 400 on it. We'd stop all that, wouldn't we? Because that's our life that's just being dribbled away. With all the, I'm saying in my book, and I think it's true, that it's never been so easy to waste time. It's never been so easy to waste time. So when I try to write my book, I've actually stopped myself doing this now. I've given myself a Vinaya, but I always resist a bit. You know, I get there, I get my cup of tea, I think, okay, here we go. I think, I'll just check my emails. No, here we go. So I just, they all appear little blue dots. Oh, that looks like a nice one. Open it. No, it's not nice. Markers in red. That's too long. Close that. Well, I can just answer that one. Okay, I'll see you at 2. And then you think, oh, and I'll just glance at Facebook when any of it goes. Oh, look, so and so's post. Oh, and they're writing a book as well. So you post it and they're saying, I'm resisting writing my book, and you put that on Facebook. And if you've got, I haven't got it. But if you've got a phone with a camera, you take a photograph of yourself. Put that on Facebook. Meanwhile, you carry on with your emails, don't you? And then suddenly you notice, oh, you've got 2 likes. So you carry on a bit. And then somebody from Texas comments saying, I'm resisting writing my book as well. Anyway, exactly. So before you know it, and then you send a tweet, then before you know it, your whole morning has just dribbled away. And you can't remember a single thing you've done. But we do that kind of stuff in one way or another. And even if we think we don't do that kind of stuff, we do that kind of stuff in one way or another. And the reason we do is because we don't think we're going to grow old, and we're going to suffer, and we're going to die. We somehow think we're here forever. And that things like that happen to other people, but they don't happen to us. What's weirder is that we know they happen to us, and yet we don't know. It's very, very odd that. Nobody would say, no, I really don't know it happens. That's not true, is it? You really told me we're going to die. I didn't know. I never knew that. Somebody told me. Even my little niece, she was only 3 at the time, and she said, do you have a daddy, Matrimander? I said, no. He said, is he dead, Matrimander? She didn't know she even had the word. And she said, did you die when I was very small? I said, no, before you were born. So she said, was I very, very small? So she had no concept of it before I was born. There's just smaller and smaller versions of that. And of course, what happens when you die? And so we all have this with a 3-year-old. So we do sort of know, and yet we don't know. We don't behave as if that is true. So why don't we know? Why don't we stop and actually notice? Why can't we take interest? Why can't we go with Channa, with fascination, and see the signs? So I think there's various reasons for this. But the primary reason is that we're not integrated enough. We're not all here. We're just not all here. So we can see an old person, we can see ourselves getting old, but we don't really quite see it. Only a part of us sees it. A sort of little cognitive part in the front of our head sees it. The rest of us just not here. Or even the part of us that sees it, it very quickly just flies off onto something else. So one of the reasons we don't know we grow old, suffer and we die is because we're not here. We're sort of somewhere else. We're all over the place. Our mind is all over the place. We're not really where we are. There's just a part of us here. It's terrible, really, when we think of it. So rarely do we live fully. I think this must be one of the great pulls of sex, is that people think that at last is when they'll live fully, not just thinking, but fully with their thoughts, their emotions and their body. Very rarely do we live fully. And actually, it doesn't happen very often in sex. Very, very rarely do we live fully, and that's a real tragedy. So often we're not quite here. Even as you're sitting here, you might be thinking, so I'm a bit uncomfortable, when's he going to stop talking, when do we get to this integration piece, and oh, how do I get home, and oh, good. You know, we're not quite here. I'm not quite here. can't quite say how. I'm not quite in, because I'm really trying to be. But part of me is kind of concerned about what you'll think and how this is going, and where am I going in this, and will you like me a bit, and will you think this has been worth going to, will you come next week? Somewhere, must presumably, that's ticking along in the background. If I was the Buddha, there'd be none of that at all. I'd just be saying what I'm saying, and I'd be not in the slightest bit interested whether you like me or not, or whether you approve of what I'm saying or not, or whether you're thinking about something else. I would be completely here if I was a Buddha, and somehow that presence would animate the whole room, because there'd be one person in the room that was completely there. There wasn't anything left. There was no bit of them dribbling away into the future, disappearing away in the sands of the past. So that's one of the reasons, isn't it, that we don't know we're going to grow old, suffer and die, because we're not here. Another of the reasons is that we're distracted. In a way, this is a sort of aspect of that primary reason. We're distracted. We're all over the place. Our mind can't steady itself on any one thing. Just as we get involved and absorbed in one thing, our mind leaps away. Even sometimes when you're really getting absorbed in meditation, when you're really interested in meditation, suddenly you're thinking about rubbish. And it's incredible. You can just be, oh yes, it's really nice, and suddenly, oh, suddenly you're off in this sort of nonsense thing. You know what I mean? So we're so easily distracted. We can't just attend to experience long enough to see the nature of our experience. So we can't attend to the old person in front of us in a queue at Sainsbury's long enough to see the import of that. That we're getting irritated because it's taken a long time, but it's not going to be a moment until we're there. You know, we're not attending enough, we can't attend long enough to see the import of that. Another reason, I think, is because we're in a doubly difficult position. Not only are we not present, not only are we distracted, our mind can't settle for long enough. Our mind's all over the shop. But we're, I think, increasingly spending so much time on taking technology. So it's not that T.S. Eliot once said that we're distracted from distraction by distraction, a very famous line from the Four Quartets. But actually, if you had to write that again now, you'd say we're alienated from alienation by alienation. We're already alienated. We're living more and more through that strange thing called the computer. And this is very new, it's very recent. It's like the portal to everything, isn't it, the computer? You can do your finances on it, you can date on it, you can chat to people on it, you can do your work on it. It's becoming the locus of everything, isn't it? And our life is lived through the screen. So people spend their day at work on a screen, and they go home and they look at another screen. And then they think, oh God, I'm tired with all these emails, so they go and sit and watch another screen. This time it's television or whatever it is, or I don't know, the going back BBC iPlayer. So we can just live a whole day from screen to screen to screen. And our idea of changing is going from one screen to another. Yeah? So one of the impacts of that, I think, nobody actually knows yet, is that we're increasingly alienated from our body, because when you're on the computer, you have very little experience of your body. You know that experience where you're bursting to go to the loo, but you've hardly noticed it. Or you get dehydrated and you've hardly noticed it. And you just want to do one more click. And you can feel yourself, look, I really need to go to the loo. I just do one more click. You know, you're almost, as you go to the loo, you're almost reaching back to do one more click. So we're sort of increasingly alienated from the body, we're increasingly alienated from nature. So instead of walking in the snow, we look at photographs on Facebook in the snow. Snow in the north, snow in the west. So in the south, we've got snow, well, it looks pretty much the same, folks. And it's very pretty, but it's even more beautiful if you're actually in it. And I sat in it today, and it's a bit wet as well. And it's not wet if you look at it on Facebook. And I think we also get alienated, don't we, famously from each other. So I have 950 friends. No, I don't. I've got about six. I do, on my Facebook, I have 950 friends. Most of whom I don't know who they are. I say they want to be my friend, and I don't like to say no. They have no idea who they are, but lots of them post photographs of snow. And cats are very popular. Anyway, I've distracted myself. Yeah, so we're sort of living, aren't we, in this sort of technological world. So because of all that, we're not here. We're not really here. And even when we turn off from technology, even when we get more concentrated, still we're not here. We're not fully here. And that is basically saying we're not integrated. We're not whole. We're not complete. We're a whole assortment of persons vying for supremacy. One taking charge for a moment and then letting go, another one taking charge for a moment and letting go. So some part of you decided to come tonight, but by the end of the night you think that was a bit uncomfortable on the floor, so we'll go to cinema and say, I much prefer cinema. And then you'll get bored with cinema and you think, roller skating. life coaching, whatever it is. I've noticed some of my friends, they just hop from one pursuit to another, none of them going any deeper. Some of them quite ennobling pursuits in their own right, but none of them are travelled all the way through into the spiritual depth of them. Probably many of our pursuits have got a spiritual depth, if only we can stay with them long enough. But we go from one to another without really exploring them. So yes, we're not really here, we're sort of all over the place. Even when we try to be here, there are different me's taking charge. I was saying on the winter retreat, and sometimes this is played out in our relationships with other people. So we're a different person for different groups of friends. Sometimes people are radically different at work than they are at home. I remember seeing this Canadian film, I can't remember the title now. And one of the things that struck me about it, it was a very interesting film, was one of the characters was clearly very, very different at work. At work he was very extroverted and laughy, and at home with his family he was very introverted and sort of miserable. And what was interesting about the film, they made no comment about that. When you saw these bits of him at work, he was very different to how you saw him at home. Some people are like that. Some people are very different publicly than they are privately. Some people are very, very different with their partner than they are with their friends. I remember, even a long, long time ago, before I became a Buddhist, I had this very good friend who I liked very much. But he was rather taciturn, difficult to talk to. He was a sort of typical man in a certain sense. He was sort of rather blocked and sort of unresponsive. It was slightly frustrating. You know, hello, hello. How are you? Fine. Been thinking anything? No. Eventually, you know, with a real lot of effort from like, he gradually talking, he always had a very, very, very interesting man. And then once I saw him with his girlfriend, and he was like a different person. His posture changed, his tone of voice changed. He was much more talkative. He was much more attentive. And that just seemed to me just another aspect of disintegration. He was two people. And sometimes we end up just being a sort of collection of people. And it's quite embarrassing when you bring all those people together, because they all know different people. And many people tell me that they get nervous when they have a birthday party. Because what will you do when your work colleagues come together with your drinking cronies? What will your drinking cronies think of your spiritual Buddhist-y ones with the beads? how embarrassing, you know, what will you do, you know, and so on. And very often you have a different ethics for each of those groups, don't you? So in the pub, I've noticed, for instance, you know, in the pub, one's quite happy to swear because other people swear. People very rarely swear when they come here. Actually, I think that's a really good thing. Nobody ever says, there's no sign on the door saying, do not swear when you come in here. But I very, very really rarely hear swear words here. And that's partly because we just instinctively pick up on the atmosphere that that's not what we do here. It's not part of the ethos of here. It just shows you that ethos has its own kind of animating effect on us, even without us noticing. But again, if you're not careful, you then invite some of the people here to your birthday party, and your pub friends can't understand why you've suddenly got so middle class, and your Buddhist friends can't understand why you've got such foul language. Anyway, I'll leave you to think about that. So do you see what I mean? The issue is, the first issue that we need to attend to is the issue of not being integrated, of being different people for different people, of being different public and private, being different at work and at home, different with our partner than our friends. One time we want to meditate, we think, tomorrow morning I'm going to meditate, I'm going to do that spiritual thing. Come the next morning, we want to lie in bed and listen to whatever it is. Yeah. So the first great task of human life is to become an integrated person. Interestingly, the way to start to do that, one of the ways to start to do this, and I'll go into this more next week, is we need to be a healthy and happy person, because a healthy and happy person is an integrated person, and an integrated person is healthy and happy. In other words, they're not riven by conflict. They're not against themselves. They're just unified in themselves. Yeah. So the primary practice to cultivate integration, this first great stage of spiritual life, is just this practice of awareness. Noticing where our mind goes off, noticing the different person we keep becoming, and keep on coming back to this very straightforward, immediate, direct sense of being in your body just now. In a way, that's the first great practice. I imagine it, if you think of the Siddhartha, the Buddha before he was enlightened, I want to think of somebody very much in their body, somebody who just lived through the body, not just this head on a stick that we end up with in the West, even this alienated head on a stick, but somebody who lived through their body. They could think, but they could think with their body as well, with their guts as well, yeah, with his guts as well. So the first great practice is to notice where our mind goes, and just keep coming back to our body and its movements. And of course, that's exemplified in the mindfulness of breathing practice. Every time we notice our mind's gone off, assuming we notice that kindly, patiently, intelligently, every time we notice the mind going off in that way and come back to our direct experience, every time we do that, we're becoming a tiny bit more integrated. Of course, if we notice our mind's gone off and get irritated, frustrated, self-critical, comparing ourselves with other people, we just create more splits, more antagonism in our mind. Yeah? So the more we can practice, we notice our mind's gone off, we see that, we acknowledge that, we fully feel it in the body, in a intelligent, a wise, kindly way, and we just step out of that into direct experience. Each time we can do that, every moment we do that, we become more integrated. So that's our first great practice. So I'd like to, in a minute, I just want to say one more thing about the Buddha's life, but I want to sort of set you some homework each week, and I want me to particularly practice this mindfulness. In a certain sense, we could do this for 8 weeks, intensively, just doing this, noticing our mind goes off, acknowledging the stories, narratives, ruminations, fantasies, plannings, comparisons, rememberings, whatever it is that our mind automatically gets into, acknowledging that in a kindly, interested way, evoking chana, invoking the charioteer, evoking fascination, stepping back into direct experience of the body here and now. So what I'd like to suggest is that if you're meditating at home, just see if you can just do mostly mindfulness of the breathing this week. Yeah. You might do some metta as well, but mostly concentrate on mindfulness of breathing in this particular sense. If you're not meditating at home yet, how about you start meditating at home? Yeah. So you might think, okay, this week I'm going to start meditation. So just, even if it's starting with 10 minutes, try and start meditating at home. And if you think, actually, I can't do stages, fine, don't worry about stages. All you need to do, 10 minutes at home, sitting in a kitchen chair, you notice your mind going off, you come back to your body. You notice your mind going off, you come back to your body. Do that for 10 minutes every day. Yeah? Even if you haven't meditated, if you haven't meditated yet, if you haven't got your home practice started yet, start it now. Yeah. So that's another thing you could do. If you've already got a meditation practice, you're already doing lots of mindfulness of breathing, what I'd like to add to that is you do a walking meditation every day. So, whether it's your walk to your tube, your walk home to the bus, wherever it is, the first 10 minutes of your cycle ride, turn it into a mindfulness of the body practice. So I live just up here. No, I don't. It's just I used to live over there. Now I live up there. I haven't gone far in my life. I live up there, direct, almost directly up there. And the tube is over there. So I can make it my mindfulness practice every time I walk to the tube, just to be aware of my body and its movements. It's about 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 8 minute walk, something like that, depending. So I might start as soon as I leave my door at the top of the stairs, all the way down to when I swipe my Oyster card. Yeah? And I'm going to use that time, every time I do that particular walk, just to notice where my mind's going. Okay, that's where it's going. In a kindly way, step out of that into direct experience. Yeah? Every time I do that, whether I'm walking to work or doing it in my meditation, I'm cultivating integration. One last thing about the Buddha's story, and then I want to do a very short meditation and then we'll finish with a mantra. So, if we were to leave these three sites, the reason I have to say this really, because it will get a misunderstanding of Siddhartha, we'll get a misunderstanding of the Buddha, if we leave it at that. So, if we were to think, really, at least if we were to think of it, our modern mind, that the facts of life were old age, sickness and death, what we'd end up with is a new kind of nihilism, just the same old nihilism. You'd end up with a stoicism, a sort of Greek stoicism. But what you need to do in life is just accept. There you go, you're going to grow old, you're going to get sick, you're going to die. So what you're going to do with your life is try to accept that as patiently as you can. That isn't Buddhism at all. Yeah. So you have to imagine Siddhartha, I think, as an agonized young man by this point. It doesn't come over in the sutras, but that's how I want to imagine, a bit like Hamlet, that he's suddenly seen the truth, and he doesn't know what to do. He just doesn't know. He just sees, I am going to die. And he sees it in that full-out sense. Sometimes people have this, a midlife crisis, where they suddenly realize they're going to die. I was reading a philosopher, Brian McGee, and he talks wonderfully about suddenly in the middle of his life he had this huge crisis, and it was to do with suddenly realising very deeply that he was going to die. And he just said he looked around at people and he thought they just looked like they were mad, going to parties, drinking, chatting, talking nonsense. He just thought people are quite mad. Do they not realise that the ship is going down? You know, it's like so much of our life is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, as they say. So, you can imagine him in that kind of state of turmoil. It doesn't come over in the stories because it's gone through all these changes, but I want to imagine him in this state of turmoil. So he goes out again, he says, I've got to go out again. I've got to take my interest and take it out again. Is that all there is outside of this mind of mine? Is that all there is outside of my habitual self? That really, underneath that habitual self is just old age, sickness and death. Is there nothing secure? Is there nothing that will help me? And he goes out, goes out with his charioteer, and he sees just for a moment a wandering holy man. And I imagine him in his chariot, desperate to find an answer. And not a false answer, not a pretend answer, not one of these false solutions that we just trot out, but an answer. And for a second the crowds part, and there he sees this man, a wandering holy man, in just rags, but there's something about him. There's something about him that's a bit more. There's something about him that seems almost a bit lit. There's something new about him. He doesn't fit in. He doesn't seem part of the rabble. He doesn't seem part of the hurly-burly. He seems a new element in the world. Whether he ever saw this, I don't think is very important. I think, again, the seeing is a metaphorical seeing. For a moment, just for a moment, he caught a glimpse of something in the world that was beyond the world. Something that wasn't part of everything. Something that didn't fit in. Something that was quite unexpected. Something that he could never have imagined. I like to think that he, just for a moment, just caught the edge of that. Just caught the robe of that moving away, And for a moment, perhaps, he was filled with joy. That's how I want to imagine. For a moment, he saw there is a way out. There is a way out. There is a way out of old age, suffering and death. There is a way out. And he could just see it, just for a moment, then it's gone. As soon as he tried to see that, what is that way? It's gone. It's completely gone. And that's what it's like in our own life, isn't it? That we glimpse for a moment a whole spiritual life. And as soon as we think, that's it, it's gone. As soon as we try and grasp it, as soon as we want to have it, it's gone immediately. So often you get on retreat, you see for a moment a genuine way forward, not a fantasy way forward, not a head way forward, which is just to do with thinking again, but a new way, a new path, and you want it, and it's gone. And that's the situation Siddhartha was in. That's the situation he was in. So normally on these seminars, I didn't expect to speak so long, so I'm going to mostly leave time for questions. But today I just want to sit with that. And I want us to finish, not with the Shakyamuni mantra, but with the Manjugosha mantra. Partly because it's our year dedicated to Manjugosha. But really because this life of Siddhartha starts with wisdom. It starts with the facts of life and the solution to life. And that's a wisdom matter. Yeah? So let's just sit quietly for a moment, and then we'll start the mantra.